look at me, falling for you.
Welcome to the Meta World Stupaloop Show. I am your host. I am A. Karen Elliott. Today on the Meta World Stupaloop Show, we bring you the first of a two-part look at Mount St. Helens and its eruption, which was the last major one to hit mainland North America. In form true to the show, there were 2 months of earthquakes and steam venting before the actual eruption, and we will have a good thorough look at the whole period. We will hear from folks that made bad decisions and didn't quite pay the price. They shortchanged the doorman. Spoiler alert, old Stumpy. The guy who is going to stay no matter what happens and how bad things get, well, guess what, he does not make it. Nothing like the old schoolboy try to take on the volcano just mano a montano. Despite a distinct weight disadvantage, we can only imagine he fought well, which is impossible to tell because we was quite possibly and rather literally disintegrated, atomically expunged in one of numerous available manners. A volcano is one of the least negotiable disasters. There's no way to build or technology around such a thing. It ain't a hurricane or an earthquake, it reforms. Lakes move. Things reconfigure, there are better places to be. Also, they smell. As one kicks off, an entire region can be tainted with the smell of whatever it is that is cooking down there. Sulfur. Eggs, if eggs were pepper spray, only mixed with the most profound stench of planetary ass. Speaking of which, you are listening to the Meta World Stupaloop Show on CKUW. I am A. Karen Elliott. This week, the eruption of Mount St. Helens, Part 1.
That suddenly live crater at Mount St. Helens in Washington State produced an extraordinary outpouring of smoke and ash today. From a distance, it was an awesome and strangely beautiful sight. But up close was something else. Bombshell has moved.
The eruptions of Mount St. Helens are becoming more intense, apparently building toward a major event. This one this morning was exceptionally violent, and volcanologists are excited.
It's impossible to predict, but one can have a personal hunch. And things are, as I said, are looking as though we're having a kind of build-up towards some perhaps impressive phenomena. The power of the eruption, I thought, was extremely impressive. It looked as though the crater were being enlarged, and that's been growing steadily. And as I said, the gas and steam plumes were surging out with great violence, which indicates there's a lot of pressure from below.
Geologists are being cautious about making any prediction about a major eruption. The volcanic ash is being blown in the direction of Portland, Oregon, 35 miles away.
Inside account of the volcano that shocked both the world and the people who battled to understand her. Anyone who paid attention to science class as a child or to have some idea of what the inside of a volcano looks like.
Here's a volcano, and here is the tube where the lava comes from, and here's the lava producer. And the lava is pushed up here, and the pressure pushes it out, and it cracks and goes through the walls, and bubbles come up from the lava.
But the picture that's been drawn on a million blackboards...
juicer, and the lava is pushed up here, and the pressure pushes it out, and it cracks and goes through the walls, and bubbles come up from the lava.
St. Helens, a 9,677-foot sleeping volcano nestled in the wild abundance of the Gifford-Pinchot National Forest in southwest Washington. Before it began to awake from its slumber in March 1980, Mount St. Helens was indeed surrounded by beautiful, bountiful forests and lakes and streams. From the summit, the views were breathtaking. Below lay Spirit Lake, and in the distance, Mount Rainier. The natural setting was a recreational haven for campers, hikers, picnickers. Thousands of children had their first camping and boating experiences on Spirit Lake at the YMCA's Camp Meehan and other youth camps.
One version was deep rumbling. Earthquakes were monitored with growing frequency. Scientists and geologists talked excitedly about the mountain. Monitoring stations were set up to measure and watch and anticipate, but mostly to watch.
845.
Limited experience, limited predictions. As activity continued, scientists talked guardedly about possible eruptions. Then, on March 27th, it came. Confirmation. LeWitt, Mount St. Helens, still had fire, the first venting of steam and ash. Within the next few weeks, fissures and minor avalanches were reported. Ventings of steam and ash carved a crater, then a second. And as the mountain shook off her sleep, the two craters became one, creating a saddle-shaped peak. Excited talk and study gave way to emergency plans. Parts of the mountain were evacuated as precautionary measures. Roadblocks went up.
United Press.
Geologists began to focus on one particular part of the mountain, the north flank, where an ominous bulge had begun to grow and continued to grow at the rate of 5 feet a day. Geologists speculated about pressure building inside the mountain. Spirit Lake, which lies directly below the danger area, was evacuated. Most residents left willingly, realizing the dangers. Others were not so willing. 84-year-old Harry Truman was the not so willing. Truman, operator of the St. Helens Lodge, had spent much of his life on the mountain. During those evacuation days, Truman's reputation as a stubborn, crusty, whiskey-drinking diehard grew as rapidly as his refusals to leave.
Dave hasn't heard anything yet. It's no damage. It's on our side, the north side. It's left me alone entirely. I'm on the northeast side. There's no rock, no ash, or nothing on my side. I had some people used to ask me why the hell I stay there, what I'm doing up there. That's my life. Spirit Lake and Mount St. Helens is my life, folks. I lived there 50 years. It's a part of me. That mountain and that lake is a part of Truman, and I'm a part of it.
School children wrote Truman, asking him to leave the danger area. Sheriff's departments offered transportation, but Truman refused. As late as Saturday, May 17th, Truman confirmed he would not leave the serenity and beauty of his Spirit Lake home. Harry saluted would-be rescuers with a false sense of security.
Mount St. Helens, by a team of journalists from the Everett Herald and the Associated Press. The stories as they happened.
It was a Sunday morning, 8:32 a.m. Vancouver, Vancouver, this is it, was the excited call on the radio from David A. Johnston to his colleagues. Within minutes, the colossal eruption had caused hundreds of millions of dollars in damage, and 57 lives were lost, including Dave Johnston. For 2 months prior to that eruption, scientists with the U.S. Geological Survey and the University of Washington's Pacific Northwest Seismographic Network had been closely monitoring the volcano.
All the deformation on the mountain was local to the mountain, and even more local than that was on the north side of the mountain only.
In the nearly two-month period before May 18, what was essentially happening at Mount St. Helens was that magma or molten material was moving up from some deep reservoir beneath the mountain up into the volcano itself. And it began to grow or form what we call a dome or a cryptodome inside the volcano. And that inflating body of magma or molten material actually broke the north side of the volcano and began to cause the north side of the volcano to expand out toward the north.
We were measuring the rate of northward movement of the bulge at about 6 feet a day, and we knew that wasn't so good.
On the morning of May 18, I was driving up Interstate 5, headed up to the north side of Mount St. Helens with some parts and some batteries for our time-lapse cameras. And as I glanced over at Mount St. Helens, it was a beautiful blue sky day, and the mountain was sitting out there, and suddenly I saw this mushroom cloud go up above the volcano and climb rapidly up into the stratosphere.
When I was down in the room where the seismographs were at 8:32 in the morning, and I heard a sound, and I just looked over my shoulder, probably just a split second after the earthquake, the big earthquake had started, and saw that this was something very large, larger than we'd seen before. Watched it for a few seconds just to confirm that. And then I ran upstairs to the next floor, up to the radio desk of the Forest Service, and called Dave. And we couldn't get through. There was no answer.
I can't believe I've camped up in this area. It doesn't look like any place I've ever been before.
This landscape did not exist 50 years ago. Power to destroy, but also to bounce back.
People died below us, people died above us.
You can't protect people from themselves.
It was almost killed three different times.
In hindsight, clearly, we all made mistakes.
We were thinking we were gonna die.
And it was in godly heart.
There has been a substantial loss of life.
I look at that stuff on television, radio, and I said, oh, poo.
This is where it all began, 10 years ago. For more than 120 years, Mount St. Helens sat quietly in southwest Washington. Some geologists point out that many people didn't even know it was a volcano. But on May 18, 1980, after nearly 2 months of small eruptions, steam bursts and ashfall, and a good deal of speculation, Mount St. Helens loudly reminded the world that it was a volcano. Eruption killed nearly 60 people, forced hundreds from their homes, did billions of dollars worth of damage. We'll begin the story with those who were closest to the mountain when it blew.
The morning we were up there, we were planning to cut the rest of the unit that was left.
I had a good weekend. A lot of fun fishing and hiking and just doing all the things we usually do. It's paradise where we were. It's all virgin timber.
We chartered a plane and we took off from Yakima at 7:15 in the morning.
More than 100 people were in the shadow of the Mount St. Helens volcano on that Sunday morning in May 10 years ago. They had come to play and to work, to study and to watch. One of the watchers, an amateur radio operator named Jerry Martin, was one of the first to see the mountain erupt. His last words were captured on tape by ham radio operator Reed Apgar in Olympia, Washington.
Oh, I just felt an earthquake. Just
64-year-old Gerald Otis Martin volunteered to watch the volcano as part of a group called RACES, radio amateurs who were an official part of Washington State's emergency plan for monitoring the mountain. On that morning, Martin sat in his camper on a ridge 9 miles from the volcano, outside the restricted zone. At the same time, Weyerhaeuser employee Ed Hinkle, at his vacation home near Silver Lake, west of the mountain, experimented with a video camera that the company wanted him to learn how to run. Hinkle's unique videotape shows what happened that Sunday morning as Jerry Martin describes the scene with his last words.
Now we've got an eruption down here. Now we've got a big slide coming off. Big slide is coming off of the west slope. Now we've got a whole great big eruption out of the crater. And we got another that opened up on the west side, a whole west side, northwest side of slides down.
The earthquake that occurred that triggered things was simply the straw that broke the camel's back.
Dr. Don Swanson came to Oregon just days after Mount St. Helens came back to life in March. Since then, he and other scientists had been watching an area on the north side of the volcano called Goat Rocks, which had been bulging outward.
We think that this earthquake was triggered by some movement within the bulge, and that was enough to kind of shake the whole thing, just like a bowl of jelly, as people flying overhead at the time commented on.
To Mount St. Helens' dangerous side, an unfriendly, forbidding crater that's off limits to everybody. Well, just about everybody.
Dealing with weather, I mean, you're going into a harsh environment. You're just
right at the edge of the crater right here, and if it went off like it did in 1980, we wouldn't be alive to talk about it.
Our only transportation out of here flew off, leaving us alone for the day. And within minutes, we got a taste of what passes for normal in this place.
This is one reason it's close to public. Some of these rocks coming down are actually as big as a Volkswagen. And a hard hat wouldn't do you any good.
Shortly after the eruption, he saw bolts of lightning hitting the ground, one per minute. So that was a pretty interesting development there.
Some people were describing that lightning and in the belief that it was fire coming out of the mountain. We're expressing it in those terms, but later it was confirmed that really was lightning that was creating those flashes inside. Let's go again to Dave Jackson. David Jackson's up at Amboy, Washington, at our microwave site. What can you tell us now, David?
Well, we've got that same shot there of the mountain, Richard. I've been listening to you talk, and it's true from our vantage point right here, even if as we keep the camera on the mountaintop, we might be able to see some of that lightning from the view that we have right here. It's been down to the right-hand side of the top of the peak, and we've seen a considerable amount of it, not quite one a minute, but several that have, certainly if you were any closer to the mountain, could look like fire if you were looking toward the top of it, but I guess that's apparently lightning from electrical forces and gas that's coming out of the top of the peak.
Compared to the rest, she was a teenage mountain, and like most teens, had growing pains. St. Helens is known to have erupted numerous times in the past. In the early and mid-1800s, she erupted again. It's small wonder local Native Americans in a variety of tribal languages called this peak basically the same thing, Fire Mountain.
The view from the summit of Mount St. Helens was breathtaking. Below lay Spirit Lake. In the distance, an older peak, Mount Rainier. The lake was a haven for recreational activities and youth camps, the YMCA's Camp Meehan being the first. Thousands of youngsters flocked to the lake over the years, learning how to row a boat even when the oarlocks wouldn't stay put, sailing a wind that seemed to rise from the blue-green depths of the lake itself.
Evening News with Dan Rather, substituting for Walter Cronkite.
Good evening. 3 days after the eruption of Mount St. Helens in southwest Washington state, imponderables dust the air like volcanic ash. 10 persons are known dead, 71 are missing, and one estimate is that it will take more than $150 million just for road and bridge repair. It is an event that defies superlatives. One geologist said today, there is no record in geology in the last 4,000 years of anything like this happening before. The tremendous lateral blast is unprecedented. And for one photographer, it was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Gary Shepard reports on these remarkable pictures.
Gary Lee Rosenquist had camped out overnight at Bear Meadow, 8 miles northeast of Mount St. Helens. 27 years old and unemployed, he was hoping to get some good pictures of the mountain to help launch a career in photography. He got off to a good start. This sequence of photos was taken during the first 60 seconds of the mountain's eruption, beginning shortly after 8:30 on Sunday morning. Rosenquist and four friends barely made it out, jumping into their car and driving as fast as they could with volcanic ash and gases, as well as rocks and mud moving up rapidly behind them. They escaped with their lives and with these spectacular photos of the mountain's worst eruption in more than 30,000 years. Gary Shepard, CBS News, Seattle.
President Carter left the White House today to fly to the Pacific Northwest, where he'll look at the damage caused by Mount St. Helens. Before leaving for Portland, the president declared Washington State a major disaster area, releasing federal relief funds. Officials say the eruption already has spewed almost as much rock and ash as Vesuvius dumped on ancient Pompeii. The White House also announced today the president will visit Miami later at an undisclosed date to assess the damage in that city's racial explosion. Weather makes it problematical how much Mr. Carter will see at Mount St. Helens. Terry Drinkwater has that story.
So I guess I had the realization right away that this was some kind of a tragedy. And on the one hand, it was this huge, exciting, and interesting magmatic eruption. And on the other hand, I was pretty certain that something terrible had happened to Dave. So it was a strange day for me.
And we were off the ground probably at 9:05 or something like that. I mean, it was really, really rapid. And got up to the point where we could really see the mountain well, I suppose, between 9:20 and 9:25, something like that. There was this terrific, very vigorous vertical eruption column. There was the stem of the mushroom or the toadstool that then blossomed out at greater height. And for most of the morning, we saw this tremendous ash cloud roiling out toward the northwest. And I can only assume that was coming off of the big pyroclastic flows that were going off in that direction that later built the pumice plain. It was a very eventful morning, but it was sobering because I remember thinking up in the airplane that Dave just couldn't have survived this, especially when we got around to the west side and saw all this ash headed in his direction.
On the morning of May 18, what actually happened? The landslide basically uncorked this pressurized body of magma and allowed it to explode or expand out towards the north very rapidly. This is what we call the lateral blast. It was a horizontally directed explosion of incredible magnitude. It caused this expanding cloud of ash, rocks, and gases to move out across the countryside to the north at speeds of several hundred miles an hour. The directed blast was really the most destructive event that occurred on the morning of May 18. It completely destroyed an area of 230 square miles in the matter of somewhere between 5 and 9 minutes. It essentially killed every living thing within an area of 230 square miles, and it destroyed hundreds of acres of virgin forest, and it was an incredibly spectacular event.
We put out new stations, and we quickly started to remonitor the volcano again, because we had no idea what was going to happen.
Before the dust had literally settled in the summer of 1980, there were USGS scientists swarming all over the area out in the blast zone, studying the pyroclastic flows, studying the debris avalanche deposit, studying the directed blast deposit.
We thought it likely that there would be more eruptions during the summer, and indeed that took place.
Saw a tremendous fracture open up. The fracture, it was as though the mountain were being divided in half.
And there was a tremendous steam explosion, a lateral blast, as all of the hot gases and water trapped in beneath the mountain slopes flashed the steam. And that propelled the avalanche material and the outer flanks of the mountain northward at 300 to 600 miles an hour.
5 miles north of the volcano, on a ridge, sat U.S. Geological Survey scientist Dr. David Johnston, who had set up his camp to give him a good view of the volcano. Johnston knew the mountain might explode.
How soon do you think that might occur?
Well, if it occurs, it would probably be no more than a few months on the outside, but it could be as soon as a few hours.
On Sunday morning, May 18th, Johnston was awake and watching. His last words by radio, "Vancouver, Vancouver, this is it." Searchers never found the body of David Johnston. Jerry Martin sat on the next ridge back from the mountain, so Mother Nature gave him a few more moments to live than Johnston.
Here we go, boy, the whole northwest section.
Martin's last words seemed to indicate that he saw the blast cloud that killed David Johnston.
Gentlemen, the camper and the car set door to the south of me is covered. They're going to get me too. Get out of here.
The forest north of Mount St. Helens provided work for hundreds of loggers. On that Sunday morning, a crew of four men woke up, and three of them went to work at their job of thinning trees. All of them might have survived if they had listened to the fourth man, Jose Diaz, a Catholic who refused to work on Sunday.
As a matter of fact, he wanted to go back to town. He didn't want us to drive back. And we said, no, we're not going to drive all the way back in there. No way.
Jane Schimanke says Diaz stayed at the top of the ridge where the group had set up camp and parked its truck. Schimanke, Aviante Sharapov, and Leonte Skorohodov hiked to the bottom of the ridge, the side away from the volcano, and set to work. Diaz saw the eruption first and knew it for what it was.
And then we heard Diaz and saw him way up above, running through the trees, screaming the volcano's exploding in Spanish. He didn't even have his boots on. He was just like a madman.
The total energy release has been estimated as something like 10 megatons or even greater than that.
The eruption of the volcano heated the wind to several hundred degrees Celsius, as much as 1,100 degrees Fahrenheit.
In places, the blast is thought to have moved at supersonic speeds.
Sound like freight trains or a jet or the ocean. It was just a huge roar just coming at us and was turning black and started shooting stuff out. And you could feel stuff coming through there. You could hear it coming through those trees. It must have been busting trees and cracking them, and then it just turned black, and it was just so much noise.
Today, Lou Moore and her two girls live in the shadow of the volcano. But 10 years ago, she and her husband had taken Bonnie, who was then 4, and Tara, then 2.5 months, camping in the old-growth forest near Mount St. Helens.
Signs that her slumber was ending. After the last great ice age had retreated northward, The Cascades were already well established, running from Northern California through Oregon, Washington, and into Canada. But there was one peak amongst them that was not so well established. Compared to the rest, she was a teenage mountain, and like most teens, St. Helens is known to have erupted numerous times in the past.
Send $7.50, check or money order, to C-9000 Everett, Washington. Better hurry. They may not last long.
At 8:39 Sunday morning, May 18th, the mountain awoke with a roar. The greatly weakened and rapidly expanding north flank of the volcano blew out in a shattering explosion heard as far away as Vancouver, British Columbia, some 200 miles to the north.
I was in bed this morning, I heard some rumbling, I got outside stark naked and everything. I looked up there and I thought I was going to see 25 on the Richter scale. I was scared, I was nervous. All I could see was, I live up there pretty close to the mountain, all I could see was the whole sky was just billowing and just puffing out with smoke, and it had me nervous, I ain't kidding you.
This explosion blasted nearly 2,000 feet off the mountain's elevation and about a cubic mile of earth straight into the air.
The path of this hot rock, the molten avalanche itself, is going to knock down everything in its path and bury it. It's probably a frothy mass picking up trees, boulders, rocks, ash, dust, everything in its path. Flowing down the valleys are the great turmoil and a cloud over top of the escaping gases and dust rising from the material. at probably very high velocities, I would guess on the order of well over 100 miles an hour, that pyroclastic flow is moving, probably somewhat slower than the blast velocity.
It is ominous, and it's right there, and we came to a screeching halt, turned the Jeep around, and we drove away at like 85 miles an hour with this gaseous ball just almost engulfing us.
Did you smell it?
Couldn't smell it, couldn't hear it, could see it.
In seconds, those hot gases melted glaciers that had stood for centuries. Boiling water scoured the hillsides like a primeval tide, washing away tree trunks like matchsticks. Down into the valleys below came a crashing wall of water, logs, and liquefied soil, at times 25 feet high, sweeping away everything in its path. This first flood on the South Tootle came within an hour and a half of the eruption, and with little warning. Several large mud flows ravaged the Tootle River Valley. The first came on the South Tootle about 10:15. The second, several hours later, roared down the North Tootle. Then around 5:30, a mud flow much larger than any that had come before plowed into the Tootle and carried away the main bridge on the highway into Spirit Lake. Down into the lower valley, 20, 30, 40 miles downstream came the flood. Property owners who had thought they were safe from the volcano's fury found their homes and lives washed away in seconds. By the hundreds, houses were washed off their foundations. Mud crashed into the front doors and pushed through ceilings. Cars and trucks were washed away.
March 27, 1980. Following a series of earthquakes under the mountain during the previous week, Mount St. Helens began to wake up. A 250-foot wide crater opened, spewing ash and steam. It came as no surprise to geologists who had predicted 2 years earlier that Mount St. Helens would erupt before the end of the century.
Very large eruptions that would extend high into the air. This would spread ash over large areas in western Washington, maybe possibly in an extreme case even farther east. In the near flanks of the volcano, there would be more damage done by possibly hot avalanches, pyroclastic flows. Farther downstream, we could see mud flows and floods.
Because this is such a symmetrical volcano, and because the crater is so high, if there's an explosion, it's probable that the debris, the very hot incandescent ash that would come down, could come down all sides. But right now, there's a very great hazard due to the fact that the glacier is breaking up on this side of the volcano, on the north side, and that could produce a very large avalanche hazard.
By early April, the crater had expanded to 1,500 feet wide and continued to grow. The Forest Service had already closed portions of the Gifford-Pinchot National Forest surrounding the volcano. Those having homes, lodges, or camps in the area were urged to leave. Using a donated helicopter and a large drop box, the operators of the Spirit Lake Youth Camp began hauling out. Most were taking the warnings seriously.
But the picture... None of them was old enough to remember the last eruption in the continental United States, and the mountain had played a sort of geological overture for a full 2 months. So when the curtain finally went up on the major eruption, it was played to a full house of scientists and their instruments. What their instruments revealed, how one of their colleagues died in his attempt to collect more data, and what it was like for these scientists to contend with the political and social forces of public concern, are what this film is about. For this was not a laboratory experiment, but a major human drama that disrupted the lives of evacuees, foresters, tourists, and at times even the entire population of Portland as volcanic ash rained down on their city. Through it all, the region kept its sense of humor. And the ash, though a major inconvenience, was not lethal. It was even regarded as a gift from heaven by a few entrepreneurs. They saw a profit to be made in melting it down and making, yes, souvenir ashtrays.
But how soon will another searing cloud of pumice and ash sweep down the volcano's flanks? Perhaps none are more deeply concerned by this question than the geologists who have worked in the crater since 1980, searching for clues that might reveal the volcano's next move. Just as we scrutinize life's struggle to survive in the shadow of the volcano, we are confronted with our own struggle to provide enough warning before Mount St. Helens unleashes its fury again. Gaping crater is little more than a shell of its former grandeur. Nothing is stable here, least of all the huge lava dome growing from its center. Giant boulders litter the ground, released from the crumbling crater walls by a warm noonday sun, or sent crashing down the dome by an advancing lava flow.
Can I come back next year and do it? Bye, Nick.
Mount St. Helens. A 9,677-foot sleeping volcano nestled in the wild abundance of the Gifford-Pinchot National Forest in southwest Washington. Canada. Washington and into Canada retreated northward. The Cascades were already well established, running from Northern California through Oregon, Washington, and into Canada. But there was one peak amongst them that was not so well established. Compared to the rest, she was a teenage mountain.
Tonight at 14, following the eruption of Mount St. Helens in Washington State, where about 100 people are still listed as missing. We want to get a late report on what is happening there from Terry Drinkwater, CBS News.
Never before has an American president come to see a volcanic disaster. There have been so very few of them in U.S. history, and never one as momentous as when Mount St. Helens blew. When he arrived tonight in Portland, just 40 miles from the mountain, Mr. Carter had already declared Washington State a disaster area, which means federal funds will be made available to help. Officials tonight estimated it will cost $50 million just to rebuild all of the highways. But how much of the devastation Mr. Carter can see is a major question. Yesterday, when these pictures were taken, two-thirds of the way up the volcano, it was clear. But now it's cloudy, and more rain and fog are forecast tomorrow. The president is scheduled to visit evacuees. He will find a spirit of resilience among victims. Many feel very lucky to have survived.
And suddenly, this immense black eruption cloud came pouring up out of the white layer, that the cloud tops. And I couldn't believe my eyes. I mean, I thought, this is the most incredible thing I've ever seen in my life.
We learned a lot about how you interact with the civil defense, with the public, with the press. And that was transferred by the press to the world. And as a result, I think volcanology took a quantum leap in science as well as applicability to society's needs.
The subsequent eruptions were actually, most of them were forecast fairly accurately by the USGS team of scientists. So when it looked like another explosion was about to take place, our helicopter crews would pick us up and we'd move out to the outskirts of the blast zone. We'd watch and photograph the next eruption, and as soon as the eruption stopped, we'd race out there and study the deposits while they were still hot, while they were just after they'd settled onto the ground. So it turned out that the 6 years that Mount St. Helens was erupting in the early 1980s was an unprecedented opportunity for USGS scientists to study hot, fresh, young, and exciting deposits from explosive volcanism. We learned incredibly new and important bits of information about how volcanoes like Mount St. Helens work, what kinds of deposits are produced during these explosive eruptions, and how to anticipate and mitigate the consequences of explosive eruptions.
And the human victims were scalded, blown to pieces, pulverized beyond recognition. The bodies of 26 of the 60 people who died under Mount St. Helens are still missing.
This program is made possible in part by a grant from the National Science Foundation, with additional funding provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and is a production of KCTS Seattle in association with KPBS San Diego.
Almost 2 years after the eruption, in the shadow of the steaming crater, Ralph and Jeanette Killian are still looking for the body of their son, buried under timber, mud, and ash. They're also looking for an explanation from government officials and experts who never closed the most dangerous area, the area where almost all the victims died.
And it's easy now for people to say, after the eruption took place and there was some loss of life, you should have done it. You shouldn't have let me go in there. You shouldn't have. You should have prevented it. You should have put an army there if necessary to keep us out. That's all just hindsight, because the fact is we undertake and accept risks every single day. Diego.
Almost 2 years after the eruption, in the shadow of the steaming crater, Ralph and Jeanette Killian are still looking for the body of their son, buried under timber, mud, and ash. They're also looking for an explanation from government officials and experts who never closed the most dangerous area, the area where almost all the victims died.
And it's easy now for people to say, after the eruption took place and there was some loss of life, you should have done it different. You shouldn't have let me go in there. You shouldn't have. You should have prevented it. You should have put an army there if necessary to keep us out. That's all just hindsight, because the fact is we undertake and accept risks every single day. And there are a lot of things that we do that are far more risky than were the probabilities of an eruption of Mount St. Helens.
Washington State Governor Dixie Lee Ray is upset at critics who charge she's responsible for the deaths of these people at Mount St. Helens. From her Capitol office, and with the advice of over 50 government and scientific agencies, the governor established two danger zones around the volcano, a red zone, strictly off limits to the public, and a blue zone, into which only workers, mainly loggers, were allowed.
But the zones were lopsided. Over there, on the south and east sides, where the Forest Service had responsibility, the zones were up to 14 miles wide. But here, on the north and west sides of the mountain, where Governor Ray had responsibility, the zones were as narrow as 2.5 miles from the summit. And it's that very lopsidedness that's at issue.
There's an awful lot of overemphasis on these reds and blues and so on. I think that people like yourself don't realize that to a large segment of the public, they're quite meaningless. Quite meaningless. You put up a barrier, maybe, and people simply go around it.
What is the air quality up there at this time?
The air quality, Robin, right where I am, is pretty good. We smelled a good amount of sulfurous gas only through sort of a pocket of the drive coming up here toward Amboy, although right now it's fine where we are. As I mentioned, that smoke that we're looking at coming out of the top of the mountain is primarily drifting to the north-northeast of Mount St. Helens, and we are, of course, southwest of Mount St. Helens, so it's blowing directly away from the location where we are. But there is quite a bit of haze or what even could be gas down around the bottom of the peak. If I can't see the camera shot right now, but if it's wide enough, we might be able to see down around the bottom, kind of hanging in the valleys around the bottom of Mount St. Helens.
Yes, we can see it, David. We can see that sort of haze that floats around the foot of the mountain, you
might
say.
David, we had heard reports of lava, and then those reports were retracted. Do you know anything more about that at this time?
No, I haven't heard anything about lava other than some of the people who are up here who had had friends and relatives on the north side earlier this morning said that some of those people had reported that. But again, then they had talked to other people who said that that wasn't the case and that it could have been lightning. At any rate, it was some kind of, you know, bright forces up there, and that's what we've been seeing again on this side, is that lightning down the side of the mountain. Could very well be. There's a shot of lightning right there as I was watching. Could very well be that that's what people were seeing earlier this morning. I don't know.
I think up to now we probably have to describe this flow of material down the mountain more in the nature of landslides or mudslides than lava. Mm-hmm. At least we can't confirm that there's any lava there.
I think that's correct, yes. That's certainly the most that we've heard. I also don't have an update on the situation on I-5. I don't know if you've heard more.
We hear that there is ash falling on Woodland, Washington. Now, of course, Woodland, let's see, from the mountain, that's southwest of the peak, is it not, David?
That is. We drove through Woodland, Washington, of course, getting up to this location, and I would be surprised, personally, if there was ash in Woodland, Washington, because there hasn't been any drifting this way, although, of course, it's entirely possible.
Well, a report has just been given to us by our control room people that there is ash falling on Woodland, Washington. And of course, earlier we had that description from Yakima, Washington, which is considerably north and east of the mountain, that Yakima was literally a day turned into night because of the amount of ash in the air.
I'll tell you one thing, Richard, about the ash. I'm going to ask the cameraman to widen out the shot as wide almost as he can take it. And in that way, you can get an idea of what might be happening in a place like Yakima, because as you look at the whole scope of the horizon from here, it is light and hazy, our weather today, and then very, very dark, as though it's a dark rain cloud, I mean, is what it appears, you know, from this vantage point, drifting north. So the incredible amounts of ash and smoke that are coming out of that mountain are forming, I'm sure if you had a satellite picture, a weather satellite picture, would show an exceedingly dark cloud drifting to the north-northeast.
You know, so we're all human beings, and someday
in Yakima, it could be quite a sight from there even.
Dixie Lee would pay for that. She may not own this service, but she will own some other one. Watch. I don't see how in the world that woman can sleep at night myself.
Ralph Killian, a logger, has lived and worked near Mount St. Helens for over 40 years. He claims the governor's narrow danger zones lured his son and daughter-in-law to their deaths. John and Christy Killian were on a camping trip when the mountain blew. Amidst the desolation of the blast area, John's parents spend weekends searching for his remains.
And I don't know what in the world ever happened to John. We've never found a thing that belonged to him.
Well, no personal clothing in John's, is what he means.
Yeah.
We found sleeping bags and...
We found sleeping bags.
Dog's collar and that type of thing.
But none of his clothes or anything. We've never found nothing belonged to him. Of course, we found Christy down over the Rock Bluff.
They were 6 miles outside the restricted zone.
We weren't worried about the mountain at all.
But the Moore family's camp was directly in the path of the supersonic blast from Mount St. Helens.
I looked up and I could see the clouds start to come over the top of the trees. When the cloud passed over, we were in the direct line of the lateral blast.
And we both looked at each other and just go, and the mountain blew.
32-year-old Bruce Nelson of Longview, Washington, didn't catch any steelhead that weekend. He and his friend Terry Krall and their girlfriends camped on the Green River Friday and Saturday night.
At the command posts, it was a frustrating day. Rescue helicopters couldn't fly because Mount St. Helens was shrouded in dense rain clouds. Scores are still stranded below the volcano, safe but anxious to be airlifted out. The rain and the runoff from the melting snow on the hot mountain is now bringing some rivers towards flood stage again. But geologists today were forecasting a quiet period ahead for the mountain.
We're hopeful at this point that the stresses that have been building up have been released and that we're at least in for a period of regrouping without any particular danger at the moment.
Always discovering new friends. Diamond-encrusted night skies, and how to cook an egg on a stick. There were national forest campgrounds on the lake, too. Bear Cove, Cedar Creek, Donnybrook. And beyond them stretched the forest. A living museum for the curious. A place as close to heaven as one could get. At Trail's End, there were places that were like living in a postcard world. In the winter of 1979, changes were taking place deep beneath the mountain's serene exterior. On March 20th, 1980, a moderate earthquake beneath the mountain registered 4.1 on the Richter scale and was the first sign of an eruptive phase. Swarms of quakes followed until March 27th.
We are directly over Mount St. Helens right now, and there is no question at all that the volcanic activity has begun. You can see smoke and ash pouring from the top of the mountain, especially on the north side of the mountain.
A concern for public safety prompted the closure of the Gifford-Pinchot National Forest. What scientists had anticipated, the eruption of Mount St. Helens before the end of this century, had begun.
We can report again here, repeat the report, I should say, that the Portland Water Department is monitoring the water supply for this area, and so far no problems, no ash fallout or anything of the kind in the Bull Run Reservoir or any other open reservoirs in the Portland area. So there's no cause for alarm in the Portland area, at least not so far. Just a fantastic picture you're getting from there. It's a fairly clear day from, except for that very light haze, isn't it, David, from where you are to the mountain itself.
It is a clear day, and it's a light haze. It's not a heavy cloud cover at all. And that's